35 points, but trading is thin ahead of the long holiday weekend. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
Stock market investors looking for bargains after yesterday's sell-off have re-entered the market, though many investors are sitting on the sidelines as the market gets ready for the Memorial Day weekend. Stocks got a bit of a lift today, though, from a May Purchasing Managers report. It showed inflation may be less of a concern than some have thought. Markets also got some end-of-the-week economic news in the form of the personal income and personal spending figures for April. They showed personal income up a stronger than expected 0.5%, while personal spending rose 0.4%. Even so, the market has a long way to go before recovering from what has been a week for the Dow, down more than 3%. Stock and bond markets will both be closed on Monday. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
Automaker General Motors is recalling some 1998 and 99 Cadillac Sevilles. GM says shorts in the car's generator could spark an electrical fire. Blazes have broken out in the engine compartment even when the car is turned off. GM is warning motorists not to park Sevilles in an enclosed area like a garage until they're checked out by a dealer. A published report says American Indian tribes could be the next large group to sue tobacco companies. The Arizona Republic reports American Indian tribes have been readying lawsuits that could seek as much as $1 billion from tobacco producers on health-related claims. The report says 40% of Native Americans smoke, the highest level of any American ethnic group. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, where imaginations can run wild. More than 240 locations across the country and online at www.borders.com.
Good morning and welcome to Odyssey on WBEZ Chicago 91.5 FM. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. The recent school shootings in Colorado and Georgia have focused attention sharply on teen violence in the country. In an effort to find explanations and solutions, national leaders have turned attention on Hollywood, among other areas, and the violent content of many films that are aimed at teens. There have been calls for voluntary restraint on the part of film studios, a greater sense of social responsibility. Some have even gone so far as to suggest that a new production code is warranted, with some explicit prohibitions. Attempts to control the content of film are nothing new. They are probably about as old as the cinema itself. Today in the program, we're going to take a look at some of these attempts and at some of the less formal ways that films get censored by the public and by the people who make them. Joining me for this conversation, Jonathan Miller, who teaches film studies at IIT and reviews film, sorry about that, for 848 here on WBEZ. Tom Gunning, who is professor in the departments of art history and cinema and media studies at the University of Chicago. And joining us from Madison, Wisconsin is Leah Jacobs, who is associate professor in communication arts at the University of Wisconsin. Good morning to all of you, and thanks for coming in.
Hi, Gretchen.
Leah Jacobs, let me begin with you. Take us back to the early days. I've suggested that people wanted to censor film just about as soon as they saw it. What was it like around the turn of the century when film started filtering out to mass audiences? How did people respond? What sorts of arrangements did they come up with?
Well, when the cinema first started, of course, there weren't purpose-built movie houses. So right at the turn of the century, we didn't have any efforts at regulation because films were shown in all kinds of places, in vaudeville houses, as part of fairground amusements, as part of even scientific exhibitions. And it was really about 1905 that we first get the first purpose-built movie houses called Nickelodeons. And very soon thereafter, we get a series of moral panics about what's going on in the Nickelodeons. Much of it is not about the actual films necessarily, but it's about the space of the theater, what's going on in the dark. And this was exacerbated by the fact that the Nickelodeons really start in urban areas and often in tenement districts. So the concern about what was going on in the Nickelodeon was part of a larger concern about lower class amusements. And you find efforts to regulate Nickelodeons, but also places like dance halls, saloons, any place where there were large numbers of people congregating In the tenement districts, and especially there was a special concern about immigrants, young immigrants, how, you know, teenage youth from second generation Italian families or Irish families were learning about American life. So the earliest efforts to regulate the cinema really date from about the time that the Nickelodeons get established, and these build into efforts to control films. One of the earliest censorship boards was called the National Board of Review, and it was actually supported by the industry because it was thought by the industry it was preferable to have national censorship as opposed to each state or city doing something different to films.
Well, what sort of, I'll address this to you and to Tom and Jonathan as well, what sorts of things did the National Board of Review or other censorship authorities want to censor? Is it the things we assume they wanted to censor, or did they have a different idea of what was appropriate and what wasn't?
Well, they, in some sense, they were worried about sex and violence as we are today, but what that means perhaps has changed because, for one thing, the kind of norms about what you could represent as far as sexuality were much stricter than they are now. So, for example, it was considered, even up until the 30s, very problematic to make it explicit that a woman was pregnant, because this was seen as something you couldn't discuss in mixed company.
So, I mean, even a married woman.
Yeah. I mean, just any reference to pregnancy as such was problematic.
Even the word pregnant did not appear in an American film until the 1950s with The Moon is Blue by Otto Preminger, and that film was denied the Board of Review seal of approval because it had the word pregnant and the word virgin.
Now, were people making films that were, I mean, people tend to think of early films as being, you know, these sort of squeaky clean little things with you know, none of the nasty stuff that you see in films today. Was there a period where people were making really raunchy films that were full of stuff that the censors wanted to keep out? Or was there any sort of, you know, understanding prior to the censors that, you know, maybe you didn't want to show, I don't know, essentially a pornographic film to certain types of audiences?
Well, there was, particularly in the period that Leah was talking about, from 1905, say, where the Nickelodeon began to appear, until around 1909, which is when the National Board of Censorship, as it first called itself, and later on said National Board of Review, began being instituted. There were a lot of different traditions. One of the main things is that film was seen as part of the kind of popular amusement, almost kind of masculine-oriented sporting world. A lot of early films had been about, for instance, boxing, which was a topic of a great deal of censorship. There had also been the fact that during the Nickelodeon period, the mass of films before 1908 that were shown in the United States were imported from France, and particularly by one company, Pathé. And there was often a call for censorship with the idea that we were getting this kind of foreign-tainted French, you know, stuff. And Pathé did do comedies. They did do some films that included some nudity. I've seen a couple. And also their sense of comedy was often quite over the top. I mean, there's a film, for instance, that called Wrong Door, in which you see a kind of countryman who's not used to the modern city going into a phone booth, assuming it's a WC, taking down his pants and, you know, performing his functions. And then you see, you know, it's a film about a minute long, and then you see another person coming in and wanting to use the telephone and then running out retching. So kind of that type of joke, you know, kind of scatology, was part of a kind of popular, you know, entertainment genre that obviously middle-class people would consider, and particularly puritanical Americans, beyond the pale.
And one of the, you know, specifically American subjects at this time, which caused some controversy, was representations of the Stanford White Harry Thaw shooting, when Thaw shot White for having an adulterous affair with his wife. And the Chicago Tribune weighed in 1907, attacking the Nickelodeon, saying that they had a wholly vicious influence because of one of the American representations of this, and it was a quite popular subject. It does call to mind certain contemporary topical events, too. So.
Well, let's talk about the issue of influence, because it seems like there's an immediate understanding or assumption that film, that this particular medium has an unusual or different or new influence on the people who watch it, and an ability to influence those people in a way that perhaps other media did not. Is that an accurate characterization?
That's extremely important. Film, until the 1950s, was legally considered outside the pale of the First Amendment rights. It was not considered to be an example of free speech. It did not have free speech protection. That basically came from a decision in 1914, what's called the Mutual versus Ohio decision, which stood until the early 50s, when the Miracle case, the case over the Rossellini film, The Miracle, which had been banned for being sacrilegious, that went to court and reversed this and granted films First Amendment free speech rights. But in the logic of why film should not have free speech, when theater did, when newspapers did, when novels did, was the idea that film, number one, because it was pictures, had an effect on the imagination that words did not. Secondly, and this is quite interesting, that because at that point the film audience it wasn't the general audience yet that it was, although it was already moving in that direction, but the argument was made that it was targeted particularly at, and this is a quote, the most impressionable areas of society, and those impressionable areas, members of society, were children, which of course we still have, this is still the issue, but also women, which at that point were considered incapable of controlling their imaginations in the way that men could, and immigrants, and also kind of lower class, you know, working class, not lower class, working class. So that there's a great deal of kind of social control there in that decision, not only a decision about the nature of film as being different, but also the nature of its audience being in need of more protection, and one could point out the protection there is actually repression. You know, women shouldn't see certain things that men can see, and the working classes and the immigrants shouldn't see things that we nativist middle-class Americans could maybe handle better. So that there's a real degree of social control involved in that.
Leah Jacobs, could you talk a little bit more about the immigrant side of censorship and what sort of effect that seems to me sort of the most alien, no pun intended, to how we think about censorship today. But can you talk a little bit about what that meant in practical terms? What sorts of things were immigrants not supposed to see?
Well, I think there's, throughout the teens, there's concern with this, and you see it most vividly, I think, in the various kinds of sociological writings about cinema or about popular amusements in general. And this continues into the 30s, the kind of most formalized expression of this was the Payne Fund studies, which were published in 1933, so we're kind of moving up out of the Nickelodeon period into the sound period, but in 1933, the Payne Fund studies were meant to be this massive, multi-volume, the last word on the effect of mass media on the populace. So they've kind of spawned endless similar studies since, and the social science is probably now quite dated, but at the time they were considered cutting-edge research. And you find studies directed towards children in the Payne Fund studies, for example, how well do children distinguish between reality and the fiction that they're seeing on the screen, and studies of children's sleep in relation to how much film viewing they do. But you also find studies of adolescents in prisons, for example, and there was not published, but there was written a book that was specifically on the tenement districts, and both the unpublished volume, which is on the tenement districts, and the volumes devoted to juvenile delinquents who were in prisons, really concentrated on immigrants. And the basic concern here, especially with regard to boys, is to what extent the cinema provides models for criminal behavior. There wasn't, I think, the same concern we have now so much that the movies will release a kind of anarchic violence. I just think there was less of that in the culture. I think there was more of a concern that boys, for example, would learn how to rob a bank or crack a safe. The actual, that the fascination, say, with gangsters or with romanticized bandits of one kind or another, would make it more likely that young men would engage in crime. And this was kind of very seriously proposed to be more of a danger for poor people because they had no money. I mean, this seems obvious to me, but, you know, there's like these studies that show, well, if you're poor, you're more likely to rob a bank because you need the money. So the concern is with immigrants, but I think specifically with kind of urban crime and controlling urban crime.
Jonathan?
Part of all the underlying logic in these arguments is that there's some sort of one-to-one relationship between what we see and how we behave, as if seeing a particular image will incite everyone to behave in a certain way, but we really, in some fundamental way, know that this isn't true. And so you have to introduce the idea of context, the specific members of the audience who are seeing a specific film at a specific moment, and so it becomes a rather challenging study to complete because you can't say precisely how images do influence people. We know that they do, otherwise, for instance, we wouldn't have an advertising industry, but we can't say exactly who they influence and how. So that's something that underlies all of these arguments about how to control images, and to blame behavior on images may be to invert the actual facts.
Let me ask. Oh, go ahead, Leah Jacobs.
Well, there's just, there's two layers here too, which I think it's important to distinguish. I mean, there's kind of social pressures which are generated on the basis of sociological studies, psychological studies, but also, at least in the teens and 20s, reports by clergymen and so forth. But then there's what the industry does, and that's always, it's always a second order thing. That is, if the industry is regulating its own images, it does so for one reason, and that is to protect the industry. So although we think about censorship as something that's meant to protect women or children or in some sense even perhaps to oppress them in certain ways, it's always a second-order guess. I mean, the industry is trying to figure out basically how to get out of trouble, how to do as much of what it wants to do as it can without running into, conflict with various agencies of the state or social pressure groups. But censorship, I always insist, censorship, first of all, if it's run by the industry, is to protect the industry. It's not to protect anybody's kids necessarily.
Well, that leads me to several different questions. But let's go back to the issue of context. To what extent, looking historically, did the actual censoring of films or the actual, decision that no, something is not acceptable, to what extent was it a sort of item by item thing, like, oh, you have this sort of scene, no, that's got to come out? Or was it, this is embedded in a context in which you are, casting opprobrium on this unpleasant behavior, and therefore it's okay for you to show the unpleasant behavior, looking at the whole film rather than little items?
Yeah, well, from the very beginning, this is an issue. And it's also important to realize that there are always conflicting people or conflicting attitudes towards censorship, how it should be done and what types of things should be censored. And when the first industry supported the National Board of Censorship, National Board of Review, form of censorship was brought in 1909, it was really as a reaction against a kind of clergyman-led censorship that had gone through things, for instance, and drawn up a list of objections to things like that there was a film of Julius Caesar done by Vitagraph, and they objected that Julius Caesar in this film was shown in a very short skirt. Similar things like this. I mean, clergymen saying this film shows kissing, etc., or betting, etc., or drinking, etc. And so the National
Board... It's always the et cetera that gets you in trouble.
Yes, exactly, right. Yeah. The National Board of Review right away made the point that they weren't going to make a list, in fact, of forbidden elements. They wanted the moral argument of the film to be included. So therefore, you might have, drinking, etc., or even short skirts. But if the film pointed a moral lesson, it would be seen as a moral film. But this, of course, then became enormously ambiguous. Number one, when they said, well, you could show anything as long as it's a moral lesson, of course you couldn't show anything.
Mm-hmm.
There were things, so it became unspoken what you couldn't show. And then, of course, the whole kind of logic of a Hollywood film, you know, the kind of the Cecil B. DeMille logic of have a big orgy, you know, in the set in the Babylonian period, and then have a minister come in and say, and that's why Babylon, you know, was destroyed. Anything can kind of be put into a moral argument. And so that there's always this kind of friction between, is it the total context, the kind of argument of the film, is it individual moments, and the back and forth play between both not only different forms of censorship, but also the producers and the industry. You know, what can we include, what can we not get away with?
One thing that I'm really interested in is the extent to which, if it can be identified, there were other codes or other understandings aside from the moral issues or you know, indecency concerns that censorship boards might put forth, but that there were other understandings that people just weren't going to like a movie if you put certain things in it. And I don't know to what extent that just emerged because that's the way people thought, or because they were being controlled by this other regime that was influencing other things. But I mean, certainly, you know, you see even now, and this is certainly not anything that's gone away, but you see movies where, you know, for example, relationships between men and women are depicted in a particular way, you know, certain issues about dependence and, you know, who has control over the situation and to what extent women are allowed to be independent actors. And God knows there have been a zillion movies where, you know, it's really about the guy and there's a nice wife right there beside him, which doesn't seem to be something necessarily that the censors would say that's how you have to do it. But it's just sort of understood that people like those kinds of stories. So to what extent, what I'm getting at in this very long-winded question, is to what extent were these other codes operating to shape what ultimately became sort of the package of things you got to see in a movie?
Well, I can speak about this in the 1930s, certainly. And active heroines as such were not censorable, but certainly any film where a woman took a sexual initiative was problematic. And you see this most clearly around gold digger movies, which are popular from the 20s on, this kind of type. And gold diggers are, you know, young girls. They're often like working in a shop or a drugstore or something, but they want to meet a rich man to like be taken out and given fur coats and diamonds. And they may or may not trade sex for money in the various versions of this that come from the stage and from popular literature. But in any case, they're kind of out to exploit men and to use their sexuality to do so. And they're often comic plots. I mean, the gold digger plot is often full of wisecracks, kind of slick urban interiors. And usually the gold digger, you know, actually falls in love with the rich man and then they get married at the end. So it's a kind of comic plot. And she's kind of a trickster figure, but she's very much in control of the situation. Now, censors in the 30s never complained about the fact that these were controlling women, but they did very much complain about the fact that they were, you know, of dubious morals. And not only the censors, but you could see from the complaint mail that came in that people were just completely outraged. Some people were just completely outraged by these films. And you find often letters from women just really vexed about these movies. And on the other hand, they were obviously very popular, and the industry kept making them, and they were, you know, they're very fun films even now. So the way in which kind of social, other kinds of social norms get embedded in censorship is complicated. And it has to do with the fact that our sense of what's moral or sexually appropriate is linked to a lot of other things, like that women should be passive in general.
Jonathan?
Well, I think if you think of film as the public sphere for the unspeakable, as it's been called, we can see that we are able to represent certain things, and at the same time, in the way of representing them, we are also not representing others. Earlier we were talking about the example of pornography, which does make explicit sexual relations. At the same time, it doesn't make explicit social relations necessarily, and so can perpetuate representations of sexism and suppression of women and so forth. So I think that that's one example where we see something that's being shown, but at the same time it's a heavily coded representation and it's leaving as much out as it is showing.
Let's we're sort of hovering right around the Hays Code days, but we haven't said the name, so we'll say it now. Leah Jacobs, can you tell us a little bit about this is probably the production code people are most familiar with. Can you talk about how it came into being? What were the social forces behind it, and how did it operate?
Well, it has two basic roots. The first is that in the 20s, there were a number of state censorship boards. There's one in New York that was very powerful, one in Maryland, one in Ohio, one in Pennsylvania. And the industry would keep records on what would get cut out of its film. So they had a kind of informal list based on empirical evidence of what tended to get cut out. And so they came up in the 20s with a list that was called the don'ts and be carefuls. And that it was kind of an advisory list, like this is sure to get cut out, this might get cut out. And alongside the don'ts and be carefuls in the 20s, there was a growing pressure to have a kind of a statement about the industry's commitment to have moral films. And this was something Hays wanted because he wanted it, I think, largely for public relations purposes. In other words, he wanted to be able to say when people complained about the movies, look, we have a code. And the actual kind of statement itself, that is the kind of justification for censorship in the larger sense, was written by a Jesuit named Father Daniel Lord. And he wrote the kind of preamble, you might say, to the code, and then the actual items that are listed in the code come out of this earlier list of the don'ts and be carefuls. And that whole package was assembled in 1930, and it was publicized with much fanfare, and I think it was really adopted by the industry because, you know, it was clear that the transition to sound was here to stay. They needed some way of kind of regulating production on the West Coast, but they also needed some way of assuring people that films were going to be censored now that sound had come in. And one of the curious things about censorship is that even though much of the power of film is in images, images are actually very difficult to censor. What you can censor is words. And so somehow it seemed like once we had spoken dialogue, then we really needed to censor film somehow. And so the production code was adopted in 1930. It's often said that it wasn't enforced until 1934 with the Catholic Legion of Decency campaign, but this isn't true. There were censors working on the West Coast actually from 1929, and films were changed starting in 1930.
We need to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation and take a few calls as well. Our number is 312-832-3124. We're talking today about production codes and censorship in film. We're joined by Leah Jacobs, Associate Professor in Communication Arts at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. She joins us from Madison. Here in the studio are Tom Gunning, Professor in the Departments of Art History and Cinema and Media Studies at the University of Chicago, and Jonathan Miller, who teaches film studies at IIT and reviews films for 848 here on WBEZ. So we'll take a quick break. This is Odyssey. I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and you're listening to WBEZ Chicago.
Support for programming on WBEZ is provided by the Chicago Opera Theater, concluding its 25th anniversary season with the world premiere of There Is a Garden, the musical genius of Leonard Bernstein, featuring the one-act opera Trouble in Tahiti, as well as scenes and songs from Bernstein operas, concert works, and song literature. Created and directed by Bernstein protege Angelina Rayo, There Is a Garden opens June 4th at the Athenaeum Theater. More information is at 773-292-7578. If you work for the Chicago Public Schools or the Chicago Transit Authority, you can support WBEZ through your Workplace Combined Charities campaign, now underway. Just look for us in your booklet under the Public Interest Fund of Illinois. And thank you. Today's programming on WBEZ is in honor of Leslie Kay and Peter McCauley Jr. on Peter's first birthday. From Dollar Day Club member Peter W. McCauley Sr.
Hello, I'm Georges Collinet. Our journey to West Africa continues this week with Cabo Verde. Murna, Funana, Coladeira, and more on the islands of beautiful Cape Verde. Next time on Afropop Worldwide from PRI, Public Radio International.
That's Friday night at 8 o'clock on WBEZ Chicago. You're listening to Odyssey on 91.5 FM, WBEZ Chicago. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. It's Film Forum Friday here on the program, and we're talking about censorship and restraint and production codes in Hollywood. We're talking with Jonathan Miller, who reviews films here on WBEZ and teaches at IIT, Tom Gunning from the University of Chicago, and Leah Jacobs from the University of Wisconsin at Madison. Now, let me ask a question about what seems to me to be one of those things that people say so often, that it must not be true, and that is that having a production, an explicit production code like the Hays Code, somehow made filmmakers more creative, that in order to get around the code, they all of a sudden, there was some sort of flowering of creativity and they became better, sharper, more astute filmmakers. I'm sure some did. But is that case overstated?
Like anything, it's true and untrue. Clearly, whenever you have a restriction, it can inspire, you know, cleverness, and particularly in the realm of double entendre. And things of that ilk, Hollywood developed a very fine sense of, particularly I'd say, dialogue and situation. On the other hand, though, and this is something, in fact, that Leah may want to talk about because she mentions it in her book, it also led to kind of narrative incoherences, which I don't know whether I think it's a good or a bad thing, because very often when you're watching a Hollywood film, you're getting one message through the double entendres and through hints and through just common sense logic that these two characters have slept together, even though maybe they're not married. On the other hand, you're also getting very clear statements, basically emanating from the censors working on it from the Hays office, that they haven't. And so that you kind of at points go, well, wait a minute, you know, which way am I supposed to understand it? And of course, it was partly, well, the conservatives in the audience and the children, I mean, at least ideally, were supposed to understand they never did. And the sophisticated people in the audience were supposed to understand they did. They did. And it's hard to tell whether, I mean, that obviously leads to some sometimes rather delightful and interesting, but also points kind of incoherent things. One famous example in Fritz Lang's film Manhunt. There's a character played by Joan Bennett who none of her motivations make sense unless you know she's a prostitute. But she couldn't be explicitly a prostitute. And so the Hays Code demanded that there be this big sewing machine in her apartment to indicate that she had this, you know, lawful means of support. And, you know, I have to admit, I don't think that sewing machine is, you know, greatly contributes to the composition of those shots or to our understanding of the character. So, you know, yes and no would be my answer.
Leah Jacobs, you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I think that's true. And I also think that one of the effects of censorship was because there's always this moral argument defense, i.e. you can show certain things in details if the film as a whole points a moral. There would often be these very boring scenes where, like, a character would come out and condemn the gangster. You can see this in the first version of Scarface, the real version, you know, where there are these groups of citizens complaining in an editor's office about the gangsters running wild and the need for law and order, and these scenes are just silly, you know.
Another classic example is Double Indemnity, which initially was banned by the Breen office, and about 12 years later was Billy Wilder was able to get it through, and the double entendres there are well known, but also there's a clinch on the couch between Stanwyck and McMurray, and then there's a cut or a quick fade to the two of them sitting on either end of the couch having a cigarette. So you could easily see what happened. I mean, it's kind of a gap, but at the same time you can also interpret that gap how you wish.
So I'm trying to move us quickly through time before we go to the phones here. We probably won't make it, but that's all right. Ultimately, what happened to the Hays Code? Why did it come apart or come down, let's put it that way?
Basically, I mean, most often this example that I gave, Moon is Blue, is given. I mean, it's always more complicated than one film, and but it's in the early 50s, I believe about 52, and it was refused the seal, you know, and Premature decided to release it anyway, and you know, it made money. And so it became clear that, kind of particularly after the war, that the audience had grown up, that there was a kind of idea, increasingly the argument was made, that whereas before the war, the films were made for all ages, you know, that you'd have kids at any movie, that now there were films that were made targeted at adults, and they should have a little more, you know, they shouldn't have to be written for a 10-year-old. And so it was basically just seen as being, you know, out of date, and then, you know, films were released without the approval, and although they encountered some trouble, they didn't disappear. And so, you know, people, it just kind of collapsed in a way. I mean, it's a more complicated story than that, but I think that's the basic idea.
Yeah, I think part of it had to do with the rise of independent production after the war. And, I mean, one of the important things about the Hays Code in particular, and one of the things that makes it distinctive, is that it was very linked into the studio system, and there were people at Paramount, there were people at Fox, there were people at Warner Brothers who dealt with the Breen office on a regular basis, and they would work out their problems together, and they would work out problems while scripts were being written. It wasn't a system that said, oh, the film's all done, now the censors get to look at it. And as independent producers began to operate, for one thing, they just didn't have the personnel. I mean, there wasn't like they could support a person who would just be in constant contact with Joe Breen or his successor, Jeffrey Sherlock. And they also had less interest, since they weren't kind of worried so much about the long term and what was going to happen in 20 years. An independent producer wants to make his money and get out. So, you know, there was all kinds of institutional pressures against working with the censors, whereas before, I think censorship had just become part of the routine of how you made a movie.
So at least to an important extent, it was the economics of the business that was driving it. I mean, if you could make money without bothering with these people, and if exhibitors, you know, people who ran the movie theaters, could show these unapproved films and still get the people to come in, then there was really no, the industry had no interest in keeping that going. Is that fair?
Right. I mean, when censorship was instituted, that was a business decision, and when censorship was dismantled, it was a business decision. I mean, both cases.
All right, let's go to the phones. Our number is 312-832-3124, 832-3124. Let's talk to Steve. Good morning, Steve. You're on WBEZ.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to ask the guests to comment on two films that came out in the early 30s. There was the one film called Ecstasy with Hedy Lamarr, and that was, I believe, very controversial because of a nude swimming scene. And then then referring back to what you were talking about, the Gold Digger movies, there's a Barbara Stanwyck film called Babyface, and the premise of the film is she sleeps her way to the top of the corporate ladder, and it's definitely implied, and it's, you know, and just thought what you thought about those films, and were they censored, or was there any problems with those two films that you know of? Or?
Well, I can talk to Babyface because I've seen the file on that one. Babyface was actually, in its first version, even worse from the censor's point of view. I think it was better, but in the film that we have today, there's a kind of cobbler figure who warns the heroine against sleeping around and kind of tells her that she's doing something bad after she comes back and she's a, you know, wealthy woman. And in the original version, the original script, he actually gives her Friedrich Nietzsche to read, and he tells her that this is a philosophy of will, and that she can make her own fate. And it actually makes the film much better, and it particularly helps to motivate the ending, where she's married at this point to a very rich man, but he goes broke and wants all her jewels, which she has, you know, slept with all these men to get. And she says, no, they're mine. But, I mean, that somehow the, you know, the reference to the self and the will somehow, and making your own fate and then protecting yourself, all that makes more sense in the original script. So I guess it was, I mean, even more flagrantly about, you know, her control of her own life in the script. And it was a huge battle. I mean, this was before Joseph Breen took over as the person in charge of self-regulation. And his predecessor, Jim Wingate, was not very successful at negotiating with producers. And there were, you know, many letters back and forth. And Will Hays himself got involved when it became apparent that Nietzsche was being quoted in a Hollywood movie. So that was quite a case. I'm not sure that Ecstasy was actually distributed in first-run theaters in the 30s, although it was obviously a film that people saw in independent theaters, and it is a film that made Hedy Lamarr's name and brought her to Hollywood. But I don't think it was actually, like, played in your normal downtown theater in Peoria, in New York. Do you know, Tom?
Tom or Jonathan?
Yes, I'm not sure of the exact places it was shown, but the situation is exactly what Leah mentioned, and this sets up an interesting thing, that at the same time that there were these very stringent controls, they were not legal controls, they were economic controls. They had to do with the studio control of the theater, and that there were theaters, usually not, kind of backstreet theaters, usually not very palatial, that would show nudie films, that would show films like Ecstasy, that would show things that were almost kind of exploitation films, is what they were called, almost created by the code. Now, they did at points run into legal censorship, where police would come in and arrest people. And I don't know the exact history of how often that happened with Ecstasy, although I think it did. But it would have been shown exactly in this kind of twilight, shadowy exhibition area of independent theaters, and very often maybe booked for one night and with restrictions of adult-only audiences or even men-only or things like that. So that there were a lot of films that fell into this, as well as films that fell into this category that were fairly unobjectionable. There's a famous film about childbirth, that was shown in this way, even though it's basically it would put sixth graders to sleep.
And I'm sure Men's Night at the Movies, they'd be quite disappointed to see that one.
Part of the reason that the code lost its grip on films in the 50s was the Paramount Decrees, which ruled that the studios had to divest themselves of their ownership of movie theaters. So it was no longer a unified industry that was controlled vertically. So at that point, self-regulation of the industry became difficult to enforce and kind of pointless.
Steve, thanks very much for your call. Our number is 312-832-3124, 832-3124. Tom Gunning, I want to ask you about something that you were just talking about, this Twilight Realm, or these liminal theaters where they're showing all sorts of weird things. Is it the case that there's always this sort of parallel cinema where, even though here are the rules for Hollywood, people are making nudie films and also breaking all the rules, filming whatever they want to film. So it's all out there, whether it's whichever stream it's in, it's all there all the time.
Well, I'm sure there are, developments within it of highs and lows. The thing is, there are also layers within that. So that the kind of independent film that might book in a film like, say, this 30s monster film called Maniac, which has nudity in it, has bare breasts, is one type of thing. But on the other hand, there would be hardcore pornographic films, what were known as Tijuana films, because they were often made and shown in Tijuana, which would not be shown even in a independent film, which would be shown in private, smokers at fraternities or, supposedly in bordellos and things like that. And so that there are probably, we're talking about a very limited small number of films and productions, but there are probably several layers to it. And yes, it probably in one form or another always exists. I've seen, films with full nudity from 1899, so it's right there from the beginning.
You mean people were naked in 1899?
Occasionally.
Hard to believe. I'm really interested in this notion that, I don't know, maybe it's a whole other show, but this idea that at a certain point there was a segmentation of the movie audience. Now we have, obviously, a rating system where presumably you're told not only whether this film is okay or not, but who it's okay for. And the current debate, which was obviously what sparked our interest in this topic, is about what children are seeing. And those are presumed, now at least, to be different movies from those that adults see. That, I assume, is something that was going on in the larger society. It wasn't created, the segmentation, or maybe I'm wrong, or the desire for segmentation wasn't necessarily created by Hollywood, but rather by the changing society after the war. And probably has farther-reaching implications than we're going to talk about on this show today. Is that right, though? Is that a response to what's going on out in the world?
Yeah, even in the 30s, this was an issue. The New York intellectuals who were, very much against censorship, for example, were arguing that it was absurd to censor films, mainstream Hollywood films, for children if there were adults in the audience. So that was always an issue. But at that point, Hollywood really was cross-generational and cross-class. It really was like a mass medium. And one of the things that happens after the Paramount decrees and after the war is that the audience for cinema changes. You know, and this is, you know, a kind of a, I guess, a cliche, almost a film history, but, you know, with the growth of suburbs and the development of the baby boom, adults were staying home. They were watching, well, they were listening to the radio and then watching TV, and the audience for films became younger, and became younger in the sense of being both young adults who are dating, who would presumably, you know, want the hippest and, you know, most out there kinds of movies, and kids. And I guess part of the urge to segment comes from that, you know, the need to address an audience that's both shrinking and that has, you know, strange extremes in it.
Jonathan Miller.
Well, any sort of unified standard, either national censorship or a rating system, implies a homogenized mass of consumers, and we simply are not that. You may object, someone may object to representations of sex, whereas I may object to representations of violence. And so it's very difficult to say at what point for which person should something be shown or not shown. I think that we all object to different things largely, and the whole idea of unifying our judgment of what should be shown at what times really denies that.
Do you think that, I think this question has probably been answered today, but is it possible, I wonder when I hear people now talking about what sort of restraint Hollywood ought to have, there's an attempt to make it seem like it's somehow value neutral, like really what we want to get out is just this hideous violence, you know, things that, acts that no reasonable person would say, like, no, sometimes that's okay if a person does that, you know, just sort of like smaller guns and less carnage, which doesn't seem to be a value-laden undertaking to say that. But is it possible to have these sorts of restrictions without them tending in one way or another to reinforce a particular value structure?
I don't believe so at all. I think that, for instance, we don't see labor capital critiques coming out of Hollywood very frequently. If it's going to be performed, it has to be performed as stand-up comedy like Michael Moore. That's permitted. But in general, here's something which is not permitted, and it isn't even discussed in terms of rating this or judging it. And so all of this discourse has to be, I think, broadened to include that sort of issue.
I mean, one of the big issues for Hollywood in this classical era was that it aggressively defined itself as mass media, that it would include all kind of ethnic groups, national groups. I mean, for instance, around the time of World War I, one of the big issues for censorship was that they, or industry control, was that they didn't want to make films that would take sides before American involvement on either the German side or the French side, that they didn't want to create tensions within the audience. And then also the same argument being made about films about capital and labor. So films about strikes and so on were frowned upon or were created either for independent distributors like labor unions or very compromised in a certain way. But at the same time that you have this kind of idea of, okay, we want to have a mass audience, we don't want to offend anybody, the treatment of African Americans, you know, is one of complete contempt for, in most cases, and extremely offensive. So there'll be the idea of, we don't want to offend anybody, except for, of course, the people we don't care if we offend or not.
Mm-hmm.
So that there's always a kind of ideology that, in fact, is not only value laden, but also often hypocritical. I don't mean cynical, but doesn't examine its own range of possibilities of either giving offense or opening up debate, which would be the other possibility.
I mean, all right, well, hold on, because I've been very naughty and haven't taken any calls, and I got to take at least a couple more. So let's talk to Larry. Good morning, Larry. You're on WBEZ.
Morning.
Hi.
I wondered, it's most of the criticism in terms of kind of censorship seems to come from the right and the reactionary right-wing, well, religious types. But there were also strong criticisms of the culture industry from the left, from people like Horkheimer, Adorno. And I wondered if anyone would want to comment on those. They probably didn't have the same kind of impact, but they're interesting nevertheless.
Well, two things. I mean, first off, historically, probably the most extreme issue in early cinema of censorship was the case of The Birth of a Nation, which was banned in many states because of its racist politics. So that there has been, censorship cries from the left. I mean, the NAACP, which was formed not long before The Birth of a Nation, was a very strong proponent of it being banned in cinemas, or at least regulated in terms of who is being shown. And in terms of the Frankfurt School, the kind of critique of the culture industry, which is an extremely interesting treatment of Hollywood. What's interesting there is that they rarely took the form of calling for censorship. What they kind of said is, that there's this kind of vapidness in the Hollywood film. And to a large extent, although I don't know that they ever directly pointed to the production code, they would see the kind of production code as a kind of example of this. So that their arguments would be much more in the terms of what Jonathan was saying, that things aren't discussed enough, that things aren't, that there's too much playing it safe in Hollywood films, too much of a sense of reassurance and status quo.
Which would tend, I would think, to force filmmakers to the most conservative types of depictions of social relationships and social arrangements and personal arrangements as well. Leah Jacobs, I cut you off before. I'm sorry about that. Did you want to jump in?
Oh, well, just this whole question about violence is so complicated because, what would you censor? I mean, that for me is the issue. I mean, this comes up in the 30s around the gangster film, and the blood isn't in color and the guns are different, although they did, machine guns were an object of fascination in the gangster film. And, it seems to me that violence can be, James Cagney mushing a grapefruit in Mae Marsh's face. Are you going to say you can't show grapefruits? I mean, there's a way in which often, violence is, or, Frankenstein about to advancing on a little girl playing by the side of a stream. I mean, our sense of what is a violent scene is really not, it's not quantifiable in any easy sense. And it's also, it seems to me very difficult to regulate in the abstract. And that's why I guess I'm most suspicious of it, because I think anyone who really wants to be, have a violent, horrifying, perverse scene could do so with a pin. It doesn't have to be a machine gun. And that's why I think that somehow doesn't seem the right way to regulate it. I say this, but I don't take my daughter to violent movies. So, at some level, I guess I just don't think that an institutional control that's applied at the level of the industry is going to do what you want it to do.
All right, Larry, thanks very much for your call. We are just plumb out of time, so I'm going to have to cut it off today. I apologize for asking too many questions and not taking enough calls today. I'm sorry. So thanks to everyone who called, and my apologies to those we didn't get to. Thanks to my guests. Leah Jacobs is Associate Professor in Communication Arts at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Professor Jacobs, tell us the name of your book.
It's called The Wages of Sin. It's about the Fallen Woman film in the 1930s.
Okay, The Wages of Sin. We've also been talking with Tom Gunning, who is professor in the departments of art history and cinema and media studies at the University of Chicago, and Jonathan Miller, who teaches film studies at IIT and reviews film for 848 here on WBEZ. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thanks also to Joshua Andrews for producing and directing, to Carol Frieders and Mike Gilmore for engineering. Oh, Jonathan, you have to tell us about your program that you're doing.
Chicago Historical Society next month, June 10th, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, and June 24th, The Unforgiven, the Clint Eastwood film. It's a series on Westerns that's associated with the Go West program at the Society.
Okay, and admission is free.
The movie's free with admission to the
Historical Society.
To the Society.
You have to pay at the front door.
That's right.
But then you can get in the other door free. Okay, that's good to know. So that's Jonathan Miller, June 10th and June 24th at the Chicago Historical Society. Monday on the program, it's Memorial Day, so we're taking a day off, and we're going to let you hear a show. We let you hear a show we did a while ago, talking with David Remnick about his book, King of the World, about Muhammad Ali. One of my favorite shows, actually, so I hope you'll tune in for it. That's all. This is Odyssey. I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and you're listening to WBEZ Chicago.
Never know how much I love you Never know how much I care. When you put your arms around me, I get a fever that's so hard to bear. You give me fever. When you kiss me, fever. When you hold me tight, fever. In the morning, a fever all through the night. Sun lights up the daytime, moon lights up the night. I light up when you call my name, and you know I'm gonna treat you right. You give me fever. When you kiss me, fever. When you hold me tight, fever. In the morning.
Support for this WBEZ program is provided by the Land's End Outlet, announcing their swimwear event. It's real Land's End and an honest-to-goodness outlet. Support for programming on WBEZ is provided by the Steppenwolf Theater Company, presenting Morning Star, written by Sylvia Regan and directed by ensemble member Frank Alati. Morning Star explores the quest for family, love, and the promise of the American dream. The Chicago Sun-Times calls the production incandescent, vivacious, and emotionally charged, and cheers for a galvanic director and superlative cast. The Tribune calls it heartwarming. Ticket information available at 312-335-1650 or online at www.steppenwolf.org.
And this is WBEZ Chicago. I'm Jerome McDonnell. Coming up next is Worldview, and today on the program we are going to talk about William Perry's trip to North Korea with Bruce Cummings, professor of history at the University of Chicago. We're also going to talk about Ethiopia and Eritrea and do an update on that war, which has cost the lives of more than 50,000 people. We're also going to talk and go to Nigeria and talk to fellow broadcaster Cyril Ibe about the inauguration going on tomorrow in Nigeria. But first, let's listen to the BBC News on WBEZ Chicago.
17 hours, Greenwich Mean Time. In the World Service of the BBC, this is Marion Marshall with Newsdesk. The headlines. The Pakistani Prime Minister says he's urged his Indian counterpart to meet him for urgent talks to resolve the conflict in the disputed territory of Kashmir. There are growing indications of a struggle for power in the Russian government after the resignation of the first Deputy Prime Minister, Mikhail Zadornov. The Russian envoy Viktor Chernomyrdin is in Belgrade on a Kosovo peace mission that's been complicated by President Milosevic's indictment for war crimes. And a conference has opened in Italy to discuss how to combat the smuggling of illegal immigrants into Europe by way of Kosovo and Albania. Also in the next 30 minutes, Uganda is reported to have pulled its troops out of Congo, where they'd been supporting rebels opposed to the government of Laurent Kabila. Plus, the IRA's hidden victims. New information emerges about a campaign of killings going back 30 years. The Pakistani Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif says he's discussed the conflict in the disputed territory of Kashmir with his Indian counterpart. Mr. Sharif told a public meeting to mark the first anniversary of Pakistan's successful nuclear test that he'd spoken on a special telephone hotline to Atal Bihari Vajpayee and told him that the two leaders needed urgently to meet to try to resolve the crisis. India says that one of its military helicopters has been shot down on the third day of its airstrikes against militants in the disputed Kashmir region. This report from Zafar Abbas in Islamabad.
The Pakistani and Indian prime ministers decided to use the dedicated telephone line to talk to each other after India carried out a series of air strikes against the suspected militants for the third day. Disclosing this at a public meeting in Karachi, Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif said he told his Indian counterpart that such conflicts could not be resolved through military means. Mr. Sharif said he also told Mr. Vajpayee if there were more violations of Pakistani airspace by the Indian planes, Pakistan may again retaliate. He said this may result in further escalation of the conflict, and a much better way was to try and resolve the dispute through negotiations. According to the Pakistani Prime Minister, Mr. Vajpayee has agreed with the idea, but it's not clear when these talks are going to take place. Since India decided to use its air power against the suspected militants in Kashmir, there has been an intense diplomatic activity in Delhi and Islamabad, with many world leaders asking the two sides to show restraint. However, the success of the telephonic contact between the two prime ministers will be known on Saturday and will largely depend on whether India continues with its airstrikes against the suspected militants.
Zafar Abbas in Islamabad. The shooting down of the Indian warplanes by Pakistan has inevitably raised fears that the long-running struggle over the future of Kashmir could once again break out into full-scale conflict. A senior U.S. official has described the situation as potentially explosive. Our defense correspondent Jonathan Marcus looks at the changing stakes in the rivalry between India and Pakistan.
Sporadic shelling across the line of control separating Indian from Pakistan-administered Kashmir is a frequent event, but India's use of air power against Kashmiri separatists, who it claims are backed by Pakistan's government, is unusual. And the shooting down of two planes, India says one of them crashed due to engine problems, clearly risks setting off an escalating spiral of violence. The fact that both India and Pakistan last year carried out nuclear tests and that both countries are developing long-range missiles capable of carrying nuclear warheads gives their rivalry a dangerous new dimension. The exact status of the two countries' nuclear programs is very difficult to determine. India is believed by experts to have a limited stockpile of bombs that it could drop from aircraft, but neither country is believed